Whatever became of Big Town? My name is Richard Lamparsky, and with me in the studio today, I think I'll let them introduce themselves, their real name, and the characters they play on that show. Ladies first.
I'm Fran Carlin, and I did Lorelei Kilburn.
And I'm Walter Grisey, and I did Steve Wilson.
I'm Mason Adams, and I played Harry the Hack.
You sure did.
Well, there's one character missing, Willie the Weep. We'd like to find out what happened to him.
Oh, well, yeah. Willie the Weep, the man who played Willie the Weep, died quite some time ago. But we'll always remember him because one awful moment, I had been having some pictures taken with my Scotty, and they had put him in the control room where the clients, the client's room. So Willie, who cried all the way through it and was a marvelous character, and as soon as he came on, my dog went, oh, and howled all during the show. And of course, those were all live shows, but they couldn't exactly take him out.
A bit of a critic.
Yeah.
An empathic dog. I think one of the great things about Jerry McGill, who wrote the show, was his ability to create these marvelous characters like Willie the Weep and Mozart.
Larry Haynes.
He's always in a play on Broadway right now.
Is Larry in the play?
In Generation. With
Generation, sure. Oh, I haven't seen it.
And this, you remember more about Mozart, I'm sure, than I do.
He was a piano player, yeah. And a real kind of a tough character. But the one I loved, well, when we talked about that Bob Dryden did.
Oh, yeah, Clammy.
Clammy. I remember him very well. That was one of Bob's specialties. He had a innate clamminess about him, and it's vocally I'm talking about. Only.
Yeah.
He's still going strong. Thank goodness.
Any of you remember what year the show went on? I know you weren't on it at that time.
Well, I'm trying to think. It went on here in New York, I would say around 42 or 43, with Ed Pauley and myself. And at that time, Ted DeCorsia was playing Harry the Hack, and Ted went to California, and then Mason came.
Excuse me, wasn't it another cab driver
was
who
another
was Harry's uncle?
Harry's uncle, that's right.
What was
right,
his name? Ted DeCorsia was something the Hack.
Eddie the Hacky.
And I was his nephew, came in when Ted went to California,
that's
was
right.
Harry the
Some
Hack.
I don't recall how many years prior to what you said, Fran, how many years before it had played out on the West Coast. But, as you know, it was originated by G. Robinson and Claire Trevor in the two parts.
That's right. Okay.
But I don't know how long they played. But when they came east, of course, it was another story. And the characters remained the same, but different people were portraying them, that's all.
The earliest date I could find on the show was 1938, because that year it was one of the 10 top-rated shows in the nation. Big Town, mm-hmm. from the coast.
From the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I must say, as a fan... I told Fran Carlin this before, that she sort of looks like the Lorelei Kilburn I had in mind, Roz Russell type.
Oh, thank you. But they wouldn't let me do the television show because they said I wasn't the type. So
well,
you never can tell.
And Walter Grisey, you look like a managing editor of a big metropolitan daily. Harry the Hack. You don't look like Harry the Hack.
He sounds like him. That was important in those days.
Oh, that was it. Yeah. That was the fun of radio.
You had a trusty monkey wrench.
That's right.
I remember, under the front seat.
Quite right.
Which came in handy.
It used to come in handy in these endings that Jerry would devise. That were always there was always a deus ex machina, as it were, like a monkey wrench. Or
that's right.
Somebody would run in and save the day.
Before we began recording, we were lamenting the fact that so many of those radio shows were not recorded because they were live. Your show was live, was it not?
Yes, it was.
It's lost now in posterity.
Unless someone took off an individual recording, that would be the only way that anyone would have it. There was no authentic, authorized recording of the shows at any time during the time that I was on.
No, and I don't think they have saved any scripts of any of the things that we've done or had any. They didn't have tape. It was acetate. And unless the performer took off an individual one, speaking about it being live, we also had to do a repeat. When we were on CBS, I think we went on 8 to 8:30, and then it was 12 to 12:30. And this caused a few problems because if I know several people would either go home and take a nap and the alarm clock wouldn't go off, or I think Dwight Wiest, who is our announcer, and played Callahan. Remember Callahan, the cop who was a friend?
Oh, yes.
Well, Dwight was exhausted, and he had a little hotel room, and he asked the girl to wake him up at 11:30. So she woke him up at 11:30 the next morning.
Oh, no.
And Ted DeGorsia had to go on and do the announcing, do the commercials, and play Eddie at that time. That was kind of in the beginning.
There's a wonderful story about the time that Ed Begley was playing Charlie Chan.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Leon Janney was playing his son. And Ed failed to show up for a repeat, I guess. This was over at WOR. And at the last minute, Leon Janney, who was playing the son, doubled for Charlie Chan in the opening part of the show, and then Begley came in and completed it.
Oh, my goodness.
When he called his mother up after the show, Leon did, and said, "Well, Ma, what did you think?" She said, "Oh, you could do better than that."
Well, that was one of the problems, I think, of radio in those days, was the repeat show. And if it wasn't the case of somebody going to take a nap, somebody perhaps was playing in a Broadway show, and the connections were a little short on either end. I can remember when I was doing Crime Doctor, when we had an 11 o'clock repeat, and when the curtain would go down on a show in which we were, at that point, doing Sunday night performances. I had to have a special cab waiting for me, which was fine if the cab didn't get stuck on 45th Street.
Mm.
Bring me over to CBS, and many is the time I literally skidded into the door of that studio just in time for the queue line, and it got too close for comfort, and I finally decided that I had to give up one or the other, and I had to make my choice. But those things happen too frequently to be funny sometimes.
Mm. Even some of the daytimes, if you were on early in the morning, had a repeat in the afternoon, which became very confusing.
Yeah, Ma Perkins did.
His mom.
Pepper Young's Family, I think, too.
Not while I was on it, no. But it had originally, I think, way back in the 30s.
Mm-hmm. In case you did your wash in the morning, you could listen to it in the afternoon.
Well, many of them did, too.
One of the actors or actresses that worked in radio told me this, and I don't remember who it was, that for a while they were recording these programs off the air, the networks were on big metal discs of some kind. Mm-hmm. And she said the reason that it may have been Ma Perkins, Virginia Payne, mm-hmm. she said the reason they're not in existence is during the war, somebody got the bright idea that they should contribute all of these to the scrap metal drive.
Mm-hmm.
So went all of your efforts all those years. Isn't that a shame?
Well, I was wondering about, there were so many recorded shows, too, that we used to do. I used to do Blackstone, The Magic Detective, and a lot of the shows which are playing now, like The Shadow and The Green Hornet, were all recorded, but I guess they were recorded on, they're called acetates, because they didn't have the tape.
Have you heard any of them?
No, I haven't.
I wonder what the quality is like.
Very
because
good,
they're,
I gather,
is it?
Still.
I've heard a few. They're really quite good. Amazingly good.
Yeah. They're having an awful time, though, I gather, trying to find out, because the actors are supposed to get a small residual, and so they've had groups of actors meeting up in our office in the other
trying
theater,
to track them down.
Trying to track them down, and who played it.
Yes.
Yeah. Fortunately, we have a recording here today, because Fran Carlin brought one along of an original Big Town show, and if our engineer is ready, well, this is how the show began, Big Town.
Lever Brothers Company, makers of Lifebuoy Health Soap, present Big Town.
Extra, extra, here's Steve Wilson in Story of Reckless Driving, Captain, Death at the Wheel. Extra, extra.
Yes, Lever Brothers Company, makers of Lifebuoy Health Soap, are proud to present Big Town. The story of fighting editor Steve Wilson of the Illustrated Press, whose newspaper creed stands for freedom and justice against the forces of intolerance and evil.
The power and the freedom of the press is a flaming sword, but it may be a faithful servant of all the people. Use it justly, hold it high, guard it well.
Does that take you back?
Oh, it certainly does. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Yes.
It was making
wasn't
our day.
Wasn't that, Fran, yes. Wasn't that particular tape made to commemorate the award for the safety driving?
Yes, it was the National Council on Safety, and we had gotten an award, so I had it taken off, plus the fact that my husband, Dwight, was on a vacation, and my husband, Casey Allen, announced it, so I had it taken off the air. But they had given us a big testimonial dinner because Jerry was quite a man of his time. It's almost what they're doing now, is that he thought the kind of ruthlessness on the highway and the murder that took place, that this should be a crusading editor's job to do, and he'd do it once a year, and it was always had a tremendous impact.
I must say that our audience might be interested in this. This is the first program I've done where I asked the audience to write in and say, you know, what would you like to hear? Who would you like to know whatever became of what show, what character, what actor? And the first time I got a letter from the person, because Fran Carlin wrote in and said, here I am, and I know where they are, and let's get together.
Yes, I had heard so much about you from Wester Ralston and Julie Stevens, who had told me about what you were doing.
And so, your druggist.
And my druggist, who had heard one of the shows.
Let's
and he
plug
said,
his
I
drugstore.
Yes,
where is it located?
Beck's drugstore, and his name is Eddie, and it's on 81st and Broadway, and he's darling.
Well, good. Good for him.
You referred to Miss Carlin as Fran. You was Lorelei, my lovely, as I remember.
That is correct, script wise. But.
And she was always going out to get a scoop when she always wasn't supposed to.
Yes,
warned.
And getting into trouble, yes, on account of it. And somebody had to get her out, one of the characters. Or Steve came along a little belatedly, usually, as I recall. But he had to come along because he had to be there the next week, and so did she.
Every year, I think, Miss Harriet Van Horn and the World Telegram would devote a small piece to Big Town, saying that this is not the way a newspaper office is run. It's not that exciting, because anything from Lorelei being... Remember that one awful one where she was hung on the meat hook in a freezer or something?
Seem to recall funny. That we had any particular supervision as to protocol with regard to newspaper etiquette or newspaper...
Jerry had been a newspaper man.
And he wrote pretty thoroughly and pretty with painstakingly.
We didn't have anybody
over us with thumbs down, you mustn't do this, or no editor would do this, or no reporter would do this, or that sort of thing.
You mentioned Harriet Van Horn, Mr. Griset. Ed Begley told me a funny story, which just reminds me of the two of them. He said that before he was a well-known actor on the screen, you know, he was a character actor on radio, and I think on Broadway, he played Charlie Chan. Well, as we all know, radio characters didn't get big billing in those days. You didn't necessarily recognize the name immediately. And he said the first big publicity break he had was they were going to put him on the Harriet Van Horn radio show, which emanated from the lower floor of the NBC building, where the skating rink is now. He said they took him in, the NBC press agent, and there she was. It was live on the air, and he was so thrilled he was going to be interviewed as Ed Begley, star. And his mother was listening, and his family was listening. The first thing she said to him was, well, ladies and gentlemen, we have today the star of Charlie Chan on radio, and you know, he's not Chinese at all. I thought, my God, this woman is paid to do this program.
Well, Ed has a storehouse full of priceless stories.
He is one of the funniest men.
And he's contributed to a lot of them. I'm just about to say he's contributed to so many, and I've known him for so long and so many years. When he first came down, and you both do too, I'm sure, Mason and Fran, when he first came down from Hartford and into radio here in New York, and he was a bit of a character even then, a lovable character, but he has done so many things, and I've been in three different pictures with him and three different plays with him, to say nothing of countless radio shows, and I've never ceased to be thoroughly entertained by him, even at times when he has... made me want to duck under the table sometimes, not to be seen.
Well, you know, he can cry. He's one of the few people I've ever known, whether it's a question of tear ducts or something, but he can literally, the tears can flow down his cheeks. Well, I was dashing on a very rainy, nasty day, going up that escalator at 53rd Street or the subway to get to CBS, And Ed was coming down the escalator, coming from another show, and he was at the top, I was at the bottom, and suddenly I heard, "Why did you leave me? Why?" And I looked up at all these people on the escalator, turning around and looking at me with this shock thing, and here he is, the tears streaming down his face. He said, you shouldn't have. The children, we miss you, as we passed each other. I'm quite sure these people thought I was a monster.
If you embarrass Easley, you're quite right, not to see him in public, because I had to pick him up at the Algonquin right after, just before his baby was born. His father came to Genova a year and a half, 2 years ago, and he was with his new wife, very pretty girl. And he was so careful with her, you know, the curbs and the steps and everything, mm-hmm. because the baby was on its way. And they were going to Ireland. He wanted to show Ireland. As it happened, the baby was born prematurely. It was born in Ireland.
In Ireland.
Right.
Well, we were walking out of the Algonquin. We turned off on the 6th Avenue going to the Forum of the 12 Caesars for lunch with some newspaper man. And a Tanner touring bus drove by and stopped, and a lady leaned out of the window. She said, "Oh, there is Ed. There he is. There's Ed Begley." And he looked up, and he said, "Where were you? Where were you last Tuesday? What a nerve. Don't ever call me again. That's the last."
Yes.
And the lady was still there probably with her mouth open. Everybody in the street. It's like walking down the street with Santa Claus. Everybody recognizes him.
She's a very funny man.
He has a habit of walking into a restaurant. If you have preceded him, for example, he said, "I'll see you there in 5 or 10 minutes." Is a habit of walking in and standing inside the door or near the captain or the head waitress, as the case might be, and in a loud voice remarking to everybody, "I'm here to meet Walter Grise. Where is he? Where is the? Oh, there's Walter over there. Yes, I'll be right with you, Walter. Just a moment." And everybody looks up, of course, and sees who it is. Naturally, I mean. You feel like crawling under the tablecloth.
Funny man.
He's a great...
He once pulled a gag in an elevator at NBC. The elevator operator closed the door. Opened the door. And Ed said, "Oh, you caught my hand. Oh, 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 oh." And he went out like this. And a woman in the elevator, as he left in the elevator, operator was aghast. As the doors were closed, she said, "He was bleeding."
That's acting.
Which
yes.
I think the audience might be interested, too, in some of the other programs you all worked on over the years. I know that Miss Carlin was Bunny Mitchell.
Mary Marlin was one of the first radio shows I ever did. And Ann Seymour was Mary Marlin, and I played Bunny Mitchell, who was a devil. And it was great fun to play, but... I guess one of the interesting aspects of radio is that people believed, not only believed what you did, but believed that you were that person. I know I was on one of the original Erna Phillips show, Today's Children, and I had a baby on the show in the script, and I got an entire layette. I got, you know, flowers when the baby was supposed to arrive. They really believed that. And because we weren't identified in many ways, unless you were doing, like, the nighttime shows where we got billing, as far as Bunny, they didn't realize, because she was Southern and a very naughty woman and was taking Mary Marlin's husband away from her. And so Ann Seymour and I had to appear at a women's club benefit to kind of publicize the show, and they introduced Ann as Mary Marlin, and the women all applauded, and they introduced me as Bunny Mitchell, and you could hear, "Oh, that dreadful girl! That dreadful girl taking Joe Marlin away! Isn't that awful?" And they wouldn't speak to me. They really didn't speak to me afterwards.
Yeah, I remember her as the heavy, and Cynthia Swanson on the lady who was on the program just quite recently, Helen Trent. Cynthia Swanson was the heavy on that.
Yeah.
Well, I think she was Mary Jane Higby.
Oh, yes.
He was writing a book about all of you people.
Yes, I
really?
Know. I talked to Mary Pettibone.
And we've got Pepper Young here today, too.
Yes,
that you know.
Pepper Young.
Indeed. 16 years as the old gag went, it almost became a steady job.
Well, you did a lot to making it that way, Mace. That's for certain.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
I cut that in half. I did 8.5 years as the police inspector on Crime Doctor, and followed that up with about 3 years on the FBI in Peace and War. And it got to a point where people were completely associating me with law enforcement. agencies and law enforcement officers, and if it wasn't, of course, they always called it wrong. It was always, in spite of what I was doing, it was always, oh, there's the district attorney.
Yeah.
You get the wrong billing no matter which way you...
Was Warner Baxter a crime doctor when you were on it?
Now, Warner Baxter did it in pictures.
Oh, he didn't on the radio?
No.
Oh.
Not as far as I ever knew, not during my tenure with it at all. Warner did the Crime Doctor series that they made in four pictures.
That's
probably especially.
What I remember,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You were Manhattan Mother, too, weren't you?
No. No, I wasn't on that. That was... Oh, she was a marvelous gal with a deep voice. The first started it. No, this was Chicago. And then when it came here, Peg Hillius played it.
Oh, really?
No,
You're on Portia Faces Life?
I did Portia Faces Life on television for 2 years, when it was a television soap. And when it was a radio show, Lucille Ball was Portia, and Lucille had a very bad fall, and she was out for almost 2 years. So Ann Seymour took over. And then Ann Seymour got a throat infection and was out for a couple of weeks, and that was some billing that was really funny because Lucille did was one of the few daytime shows that in which the star of the show got billing. In other words, it was Portia Faces Life with Lucille Wall. So that it became this, Portia Faces Life with Lucille Wall, currently being played by Ann Seymour, who is currently ill and being played by Fran Carlin. It was longer than the show. By the time
30-minute show.
Yes, that's it.
Were you on Stella Dallas?
I was on Stella, as we all were, in what we called the Hummert Stable. We went from one show to another, like you do a sequence of maybe 13 weeks or 26 weeks on Young Widder Brown or David Harum, and then you'd get through with one of those, then you'd go into perhaps playing completely different type part into... Stella Dallas and...
Our Gal Sunday.
And I was on Our Gal Sunday for about 15 years as her best friend and next-door neighbor, Irene Galway. And it was always said that way. It was never just Irene Galway. It was her best friend and next-door neighbor.
Well, Stella was on the show around about Christmas.
Oh, Miss Elsner.
Yes, I went all the way to Lambertville, New Jersey to
her fantastic restaurant.
Chisholm, lovely restaurant.
Oh, you did it down there? From there?
Yes, mm-hmm. I drove forever. Well, actually, it isn't that far. But
no, it's
kind of all.
It's kind of a fur piece, as they say.
She's a mad, mad lady.
Yes. She wore wonderful hats with feathers on the top, which were kind of distracting.
Well, she probably got them from those birds that are in that aviary in the restaurant.
I probably have the distinction of being one of the few radio actors who never worked for Air Features.
Never?
I never did any of those shows. I wonder sometimes how I survived.
Were you blacklisted from the
moment?
He
was too busy, probably.
Some people, you know, as you said, it was a stable.
Yeah,
that's true. Stock company.
What you called in those days a running part on a certain soap opera, a certain serial. And when that running part ran out, if you were a part of the stable, so-called, they'd take care of you by fitting you into a running part on another one of their shows.
Dick Widmark was one of the leading lights of the...
I was on with Dick when we did Front Page Farrell.
Yeah. Sure.
Or before he went west.
Matter of fact, I made my Broadway debut in a play with Ed Begley that was Dick's second play and the first one in which he played a major role, Get Away, Old Man. And that was Ed's first play on Broadway. He was very good, too. And Dick was also...
You know, another thing that seems to have gone along with the audience just listening and not looking is that, do you remember the giveaways that were on?
Surely.
And they used to, you at least were spared that then, Mason, if you didn't do the Hummert shows, because they would incorporate the giveaway into the script. So, for example, in David Harum, if they had a scene together, and a very romantic scene, and we had to go out into a flower garden, and they'd say, oh, look at the beautiful flowers. Yes, Burpee's seed, and we would start writing. They incorporated it within the show, and on Backstage Wife once, I was the villain of the piece at this time. I was always locking somebody into the hexagonal room. I never could quite understand that. And They said they had a giveaway of a pin, very much like the one on the Helen Trent thing that they used to do, the solid gold, almost, heart-shaped pin, you see. So the one of the people on the show had to look at me and say, "Oh, you can't be all bad. I see that you are wearing the heart of gold pin that we are giving, you know," and this went on. And we used to have to do it within the content of the script.
I got inquiries about a very famous radio personality, Mr. Keene, and I think maybe Walter Grisey could tell us about Mr. Keene.
We were talking about that, not only the program, but the actor who played it for so long outside, and neither Fran Carlin nor myself could come up with his name, and I wonder whether Mason can, by any chance.
No. Well, it isn't Alonzo Dean.
No. I know it the moment I heard it, but according to my best information, he's been gone for some little time.
Yeah.
But he played it for so long that he became so well identified as Mr. Keene, the tracer of lost persons, that I know that he was called that on the outside, because his voice was so distinct, his characterization was so definite all the way through.
I'm the old investigator, with Pat Clancy, isn't it?
That, with a touch of...
And, well, he said Mike Kelly.
Yes, sir, along with it, too.
Does a lot of commercials. He's still around, yes. Mike Kelly. He's still around. He does a lot of commercials. I run into him every once in a while. Yeah.
I haven't seen Mike in a long, long time.
And Mystery Theater. There used to be all the... See, what we would do so many times, as you did all the shows during the day, then there'd be the shows at night, and you'd have to kind of fit in if you're doing a nighttime show, which usually if you were just playing a supporting part, the nighttime shows paid better, naturally. They were bigger shows, and they paid better. So there was another thing that I guess is gone, too, is that there used to be stand-ins. Because a lot of us, there's one particular time on Big Town, I think, where there was one single person that was of the original cast, and everybody was off, either rehearsing a play or doing a nighttime show, and then they come slipping in for the rehearsal part of the afternoon and run out again, or we would be doing something else. And Jerry was darling and allowed this quite often. And we had some very famous people that broke into this business.
Sometimes happened right up. True, and including the dress
into the
rehearsal, so-called.
In some cases.
Somebody would come in and open the door and go to the mic, the open mic, and report to the director and said, "I'm so-and-so and so-and-so standing in for Joe Doakes. He won't be here until 20 minutes or four," and so forth. "All right, go ahead. Here's a script." And that's the way it was done.
I told some kids recently, they're in their 20s, they're kids to me, that I had seen some star that asked me if I'd ever seen, I don't know who it was, John Barrymore, somebody like that. And I said, "Yeah, I saw him once in a radio program."
Mm-hmm.
They said, "Were you on radio?" I said, "No, but I was in the audience." I said, "An audience of a radio program?" They thought that was so funny, but you all met.
Yes.
Sure.
Well, for a long time, they had the Hollywood stars here every...
Well, Theater Guild on the Air.
Armstrong Theater every Saturday. I used to play opposite all the stars.
Before that, I know that I worked with Wally Beery when he did a radio show. Who was the director that did all of those?
Homer Fickett, you mean?
Homer did the Theater Guild. I'm not talking about that. Not Cavalcade either. This is before that. Any of those.
Oh, well, then I wasn't here.
Before any of those happened. And a big star name, each program, each week, and the same director did it, and some of the biggest ones from Hollywood came in, and each week were on this particular show. This was prior to Cavalcade, prior to Armstrong, prior to Theater Guild of the Air.
And they also used to have a lot of them who did not know radio well.
True.
They would paste the individual pages of their scripts on pieces of cardboard. And I had to do a show with Miss Constance Bennett, and when we got on the air, she just decided that this was confusing. So as we went along, and it always seemed to be on my line, then she would take the cardboard and just drop it. So it would thud right at the foot of the base of the microphone as I started to talk. I got a little outraged.
There were times on radio when four or five and sometimes more actors and actresses would surround one microphone, and if you were a pro, so-called, and knew your way around, you got in there to get your lines over. And if you weren't, you just didn't stand a chance in the world.
I wonder how the men did, because high heels were awfully good once in a while.
We're helpful. I mean,
yeah, and elbows.
Most everybody cooperated with most everybody else. There were a few who didn't.
I think that's one of the lovely things about radio. There was a very happy group of people. They seemed to get along beautifully. We saw each other on lots of shows and worked together well, and it remained, a lot of us, very good friends.
I think for the most part that's perfectly true. Happy to say.
I have seen that, because when I first started doing this program, I had maybe one or two names of people who played characters or who were themselves on radio. And they all knew where the other ones were, you know. I mean, Lanny Ross knew where Jessica Dragonette was, who knew where Lucy Monroe was. And all the people who played characters all seemed to know each other and were very helpful and said, oh, yes, I had lunch with her. I saw him the other day. And by all means, I'm sure he'd love to do it. Which is how we got this show together.
In the other mediums, you have other problems. You have makeup problems, you have costume problems, you have line problems, you have contact problems that you never had in radio.
That's
you never had with some Alpha, you never had to come up against them.
Unfortunately, we're, as Jack Benny used to say, we're a little late, folks, so we have to say goodnight in just a moment. And thanks very much to Mr. Walter Grisey, Ms. Fran Carlin, and Mr. Mason Adams for putting together the Big Town Show. Next week, I will be speaking with a man who was, until 1947, the world's most famous harmonica player. His name is Larry Adler. In 1947, he was blacklisted from radio, television, and motion pictures. He lives now in London, and I'll be talking with him about the blacklist and how he feels about his native country. This is Richard Lamparski. Thank you for listening. And tune in again next week at the same time for Whatever Became of Larry Adler.